following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
That's awesome. Awesome.
That's awesome.
Awesome. Awesome.
Oh, dude, that's awesome.
That's
awesome.
Really awesome.
Awesome.
That's awesome.
Awesome. Oh, awesome. That's
awesome.
With Stephen Bradford. Stevie B, what's going on, dude?
What are you doing?
Dude, we are in a bit of an echo chamber.
We are a little bit because we're in a beautiful high rise.
A beautiful high rise in downtown Los Angeles.
Okay, tell them the location, man.
Yeah, right? Yeah. We're next to some beautiful museums and theaters.
You know what's funny is ever since I've lived here in 86, I came here, and I know before that, they try to make downtown a place where people live.
Sure.
Well, now it's finally happening.
People live here.
Finally.
We're sitting next to someone that lives here.
I know. So our guest today, I have known for a long time. And there's a lot of stories that we could tell about each other that we probably won't.
Oh, I'm going to try to get some.
On the podcast.
I'm going to try my hardest.
We have a great guest today. He's a really talented guy, sweetheart of a man. And my cousin by marriage.
That's right. Brother by TV, cousin by marriage.
And we didn't find out until we were on TV.
Brothers in hair.
Brothers in arms. Sean Kanan.
Hey, you guys. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to see both of you.
Likewise, man. We worked together for maybe, what? I don't know.
A little over a year.
And that was, when was that? 2012?
Oh, it was for the 50th anniversary for GH.
No. Six years ago. Yeah.
No, it wasn't 6 years ago.
Yeah, because we're on 56 years right now. Yeah.
Really?
Wow. Gotcha. So, 1963, so 2013, I guess.
There you go.
Yeah, time flies, you guys.
Yeah.
No kidding, right?
Man.
I mean, Sean, I think the older especially for you and I.
I mean, the older you get, the faster it seems to go.
It sure does. Yeah. It sure does. I mean, we met
I'm going to say around 89, right? Maybe earlier.
I would say 89.
Had I done Karate Kid yet? Because 89 was when I did it.
Okay, yeah, so it might have been 90.
Yeah.
Because you had just come out and you had just gotten Outsiders.
That was after I did Karate Kid, yeah, because I came out in 87.
Okay, so hold on. There's so much to talk about. But one of the coolest things ever is Karate Kid 3. This is amazing.
Absolutely. I still have one of those drums that you put in between your hands.
From Karate Kid 2, yeah.
That was two in Okinawa, not three. Sorry, right. Sorry. I'm interested in your backstory. You didn't grow up in a showbiz family or anything, right?
No, not at all.
Yeah. Where are you from?
I'm originally from Newcastle, Pennsylvania, which is in western Pennsylvania. And I grew up in a family. We had a chain of jewelry stores that my father ran. We had 52 jewelry stores at one point in time.
Jeez, dude,
and
52.
I was the guy, man. I was supposed to take them over.
Wow.
And just decided that that really wasn't for me. And I knew I wanted to act from a pretty young age.
How?
Yeah. What age?
I think I was around 13 or 14, and I knew I wanted to do something creative. You know,
yeah.
I wanted to do something to express myself, and I wasn't sure what it was. I think coming from a relatively small town, you tend to dream big. I mean, I knew I wanted to get out of there. It was interesting. We were about 5 miles away from the Amish people.
Right.
So, it was not uncommon to see a horse and buggy coming by, but it was a city. And when I was about 15 or 16, I started modeling in Pittsburgh.
Oh.
And eventually went to school in Boston at Boston University. I was studying political science, started dabbling in some acting classes.
Whoa, yeah. That's amazing, dude. I love that.
Finished up at UCLA with my degree in poli-sci. And
why'd you move from Boston to LA?
Because I wanted to start my acting career.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it was a conscious choice. You were enrolled as an undergrad at BU.
At BU.
And you're like, Boston's great, but I got to get to LA.
I knew I had to go to New York or LA.
Sure.
So
were you like doing a minor in acting or studying acting or?
No, I was dabbling, taking a couple classes.
Okay. Yeah.
But I was all poli-sci because because I come from a business background family. They were like, look, you can go do whatever you want, act, but you're getting your degree and you probably got to get
practical.
In something so that if the acting doesn't work out, you can go to law school or something like that.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So when did you not audition? Was Karate Kid 3 a regular audition?
No, it was very much not a regular audition.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to – I remember you telling me
the
story.
Okay, so you want to hear the story about Karate Kid first?
Yeah, that's amazing.
Okay, so I had started taking martial arts when I was about 13. I was very involved in it. And at a certain point, my martial arts school joined a much bigger school headed by a guy named Fumio Demura. And Sensei Demura also happened to be Pat Morita's stunt double. And he knew that I wanted to act, and he knew that I was in – Los Angeles trying to be an actor, and he said to me, he's got this real thick Japanese accent, and he says, hey, Sean, you need to go try for Karate Kid part. And so they were having this open call, and I showed up at the casting director's office. Her name was Caro Jones. I'll never forget this. And I said, hey, I'm a real actor. I've got my SAG card, and I've done a couple episodes of TV. Can I not audition? And she's like,
That's amazing. Can you just give me the role?
Well, no, what I meant was not go to the open call. So she's like, no. And I went to the open call, and there were 1,500 guys wrapped around the outside of the studio.
Oh, God. And, for that one role.
For the role of Mike Barnes, which was described in the breakdowns as a white Mike Tyson. And and so John Avildsen, who had won the Academy Award for Rocky and who had directed the other Karate Kid installments, was walking up this line. And he was stopping every now and then and asking the hopefuls to do some kind of an improv with him. And I knew I had to get his attention. I knew I'd have about a second to do it. And I got his attention, and he asked me to do a quick improv with him. And he said, I buy it. And the next thing I knew, I was inside the studio in a soundstage.
Dude.
They had built a set, and there was Ralph Macchio. Now, you gotta
No, wait. This is all in one day?
All in one day.
Macchio came to the open call?
Well, they brought like 10 of us in there to audition with them.
Wow.
And I mean, you got to remember something. I was a year before, I was a paying member of a theater audience watching Karate Kid 2.
Sure.
And now here I am, and they bring me onto the stage with Ralph Macchio, and they said, they said, we want you to intimidate him. And so I was like, I think I got this covered. And, and I did. And,
apparently you did, because I saw the movie.
But you know what's funny is they actually hired somebody else. They hired another guy. They worked him for about 2 days, and I guess he just
so
was
after your open call. Someone else got the job.
Yeah, someone else got the job,
okay.
And I was crushed. I mean, I was just beyond crushed. You know, driving back from the studio, and you know, I was looking up at the Hollywood sign. And Steve, you know this, and you know this as an actor.
Sure.
The Hollywood sign either smiles at you or it smirks at you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and it was definitely smirking that day. And about a week or so later, I got a call to come back to the producer's office, and I knew something was up. You know, they're not going to call me back to tell me,
right,
once again, you don't have the part.
Right.
So I'm driving down Sunset Boulevard, racing to make it to the studio. My mind is going a million miles an hour.
Sure.
And I get there, and there's Robert Mark Kamen, who wrote the Karate Kid films, and also he's written Taken, and he's written all these big films.
Yeah.
And he's also a black belt, and he asked me to go through some basic moves with him, which I did, and he's like... He said, stay here. So he goes into this room, and he's talking to Shel Schrager, who was the producer, and John Avildsen. Next thing I know, they send me to wardrobe. And I'm like, what? And they go, yeah, oh, by the way, this is how much you're making a week. I was like, great. I got put through the works.
Like,
oh my,
dude,
God.
That's crazy.
Later,
it happened that fast.
It happened that fast. And that night...
Did you have an agent at the time?
I had an agent, but I had a terrible agent who couldn't even get me an audition. I did have a manager that was a really good manager. And I'm driving back, and I called my parents, and I'm like, you're not going to believe what's happening. And they kind of didn't believe it at first.
Right.
And, you know, it changed my life.
So was it basically the next day you were on the set?
I don't remember if it was the next day, but it was the next day, because we had about a six-week rehearsal process, because there was so much martial arts in it that, you know, the choreography was, you know, it was significant.
Yeah.
There's a lot of choreography to be learned, getting in shape, everything. And, you know, I was a green kid. I mean, I really hadn't even started studying acting yet.
Yeah. But you were, I mean, for that being one of your first films, you were really good at
it.
No, I mean, you were.
I appreciate
really good.
That. I appreciate
you did a great
that.
Job. Now, when was that? Were you a Cobra Kai or no?
Oh, I was the.
You were the Cobra
the
Kai.
Main Cobra Kai
and
guy at the time. Yeah,
your buddy.
Oh, Steve Billy Zabka.
No, the other the teacher.
Oh, Thomas Ian Griffith, who played.
Yes.
Played Terry Silver. Yeah,
he was awesome.
He was my teacher. Yeah,
yeah, it was cool.
Does he still have that thing in the back?
He does not. He does not. His hair has gone completely white.
Man, yeah, he was so slimy, yeah. Just deliciously yeah. slimy.
So you were, see, I thought you were back in Pennsylvania when you got this. So you were out
no,
here.
No, I was already out here.
Right. So yeah. So then this movie comes out. It's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, the interesting thing was, you know, Ralph and Pat Morita had done all the press they wanted to do in the first two films. So all of the press kind of fell to me. Because they didn't want to do it. They were like, we've done it, whatever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like overnight, you know, there's nothing like a studio press machine. Oh, I mean, we all know it from being, you know, working on General Hospital. But this is like, this is even a different level.
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. And, you know, People Magazine and this and that and all this crazy stuff. And then I had an accident while I was filming and I almost died. And that just spun the publicity machine even further out of control. I'm getting kind of goosebumps talking about it. You want me to tell you that story?
Yeah, if you don't mind, it sounds fascinating.
Okay, so we were about 2 weeks.
Yeah, great, Bradford. Well, but hey, Sean, you almost died. That sounds.
No, but
really
I wasn't
like
sure.
Really
I wasn't sure when he said goosebumps. I wasn't sure if he's like, I can't. No, I don't want to relive this.
Yeah, I'll tell you.
Listen, this guy will still kick you right in the face.
I have no doubts.
I don't either.
No doubts. Although my face could use a rearrangement. I'm like, couldn't hurt.
So we'd been filming for about 2 weeks, and we broke for Christmas, and I decided I was going to go to Las Vegas with a girl I was dating at the time. And I started having some really significant pain in my left thigh, and I thought that it was from all the karate that I was doing. So I started taking handfuls of aspirin.
That's a good idea.
So we drove through the desert. We wind up going to Vegas. We're at a casino, and I remember I had three $100 bills in my hand. And I looked over at the girl, and I said, I think I'm going to pass out. Boom, I hit the ground. Sort of come to, and the paramedics are there, and they said, I heard him. They're like, he's in shock. He's lost a ton of blood. We got to take him to the hospital. This is Christmas Day, 1990, I think, 89 or 90.
Wow.
And it turns out I had perforated my omentum, which is a sheath of tissue that wraps around our intestine.
Yeah, Dr. Oz when talks about you gathering fat there in your omentum.
Well, I wish I had more fat at the time. not so much now, but then.
That's how I learned about it from Dr. Ross. Yeah.
Thank you. Now you're 50. Shut up.
And so, you know, taking the aspirin exacerbated the bleeding.
Oh, right.
And so it was Christmas Day. They got me in there and they said.
So you had internal bleeding.
Internal bleeding.
Do they know what? Was
they don't know. They don't know what it's from. I mean, they don't know where it's coming from.
Sure.
And so they said, look, we have to operate on you. And I figured, okay, you mean Monday? And they said, no, in 15 minutes. And I will never forget this.
Dude, everything happens fast for you in life.
Everything happens fast.
You get a job, you get a surgery.
Oh, my God, right? And I remember this beautiful nurse came over and said to me, she said, look, you know, we're going to try and save your life. And I was like, try and save my life? I said, I'm in the best shape of my life. I'm 21 years old.
Right, what do you
I'm
mean?
Doing a martial arts movie. And she's like, you've been bleeding for days.
Oh, my
God. And so they take me in the OR, and the girl I was with is calling my parents. My parents could only get one ticket because that's all that was available. So my dad flew out. And I remember this was at Humana Sunrise Hospital in Vegas, and this doctor was about to put me under. And I said, please tell me you're good. And he goes, don't worry, don't worry. And I said, no, tell me you're good. And I grabbed him by his lapel and pulled him down to me, and I said, I want to hear you say that you're good. And he said, I'm good. And I said, listen, I come from a family of doctors. And I said, whatever you do, if you can avoid resecting the abdominal muscles, please do it. Because I knew if they cut my abdominal muscles, I'm out of the movie.
Oh,
if
gosh.
They could resect them, I got a chance of getting back in. So they resected them. I come to in recovery. My dad's there, freaked out. I mean, freaked out. You know,
of course.
You know, they get a call. Your kid's going into emergency surgery.
Yeah, that's crazy talk.
And so I get a call from the studio. No flowers. No, hey, how you feeling, kid? Be back at the studio in 10 days or you lose the part. And they were going to hire Brandon Lee, Bruce Lee's son.
Yeah.
And I had staples all up and down my stomach. I still have a scar this big. And I remember.
Yeah, I didn't know that's what that scar was from.
Chances are it was your work on the film that caused you to get injured.
Oh, it absolutely was. It was, and it had nothing to do with martial arts. I was doing I know exactly what it was. Oh. I was doing a stunt in the Cobra Kai dojo where I was standing in a stationary position and I had to sort of jump about a foot and fall on my side. And it was going to be a shot. They were going to match two shots, like me getting thrown through a window and then landing on the ground. And we did it again and again and again. And it was like somebody just beating
down
on me. You know, I don't even remember if there was a mat.
Back then, doesn't matter. Okay, yeah. You didn't do it.
And the day after I had the surgery, or maybe it was 2 days after, I got out of bed and I walked around the hospital floor one time. And the next day I walked around 10 times. And the day after that, I had them discharge me against medical advice, staples and everything. And I went back to the set and they said, okay, we're gonna have a stuntman do all your karate and we'll shoot close-ups of you. And so I'm watching this stuntman and frankly, I was better than he was. And I had moved mountains to get this part. And so I was determined that I was going to get back in the film and do everything. So they put me with this guy who was an ex-NFL player for the Rams, the old Rams. His name was Kyle Borland. And this guy started training me. And the first day, it was 10 sit-ups, and then 100, and then it was 500. And I wound up doing every single scene in the movie with the exception of one. There's a scene where me and the other ne'er-do-well hooligans are in a convertible Mustang, and we're doing a donut, and then we drive across these train tracks just as a train comes. And I was like, there's no way I'm doing that. So,
dude, first of all, it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Knowing you.
Yeah.
Because of your work ethic, your determination, in general. But, I mean, that's just a crazy story. I'd love to grab the doctor.
Dude, that's so cinematic. I mean, I could be a feature, but like Sean fights for his life. At least as a short. Liked it.
I mean, that's right? It's a pretty amazing story.
Yeah, man.
You know, the interesting thing about that is when we're young, you know, you think you're immortal, right?
Course,
and yeah. I mean, believe me, I thought I was immortal. And very quickly on that day in the hospital, I learned I wasn't. But the other thing I learned is that, you know, I've got some fight in me, and it really kind of showed me a part of my personality and character that up until that point I didn't know that I had.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's true. It's the adversities in life that teach you who you are.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've definitely had my fair share of them, but I honestly wouldn't change that experience for anything.
Yeah, that's a life-changing moment for sure.
Yeah, I mean, people always talk about when they're faced with their own mortality, how it changes them. But you're still 20. How old were you when it happened?
Oh, when it happened, I think you meant now. I think it was 1989, so I was like 22, maybe.
So you still get a lot of that young, dumb part of you.
Yeah.
So how long did that stay with you? That, like, I almost died, I'm so lucky to be here. Did that stay with you forever?
Did you feel, after you conquered that, did you feel a little more like, hey, I just beat this, I'm kind of the man? No, I mean, because you could definitely feel that way. Like, hey, I'm the man. I beat it.
I beat death.
I was extremely humbled and appreciative.
Right.
You know, I still, of course, did a lot of stupid shit,
it was
a real wake up call.
Yeah, man,
yeah, it was. And I'll never forget, you brought up that I did The Outsiders.
Yeah,
I did The Outsiders right after I did Karate Kid 3. I went from work right after. So I went from working with.
So did Karate Kid 3 come out yet?
Karate Kid 3 came out, I think. Yeah. And I'd worked with John Avildsen, who won the Oscar for that. And I rolled right into The Outsiders, which was produced by Francis Ford Coppola. And
it was a huge deal.
Billy Bob Thornton was in it. And,
oh, yeah.
And so one of the guys in the TV series was David Arquette. And I'll never forget, you know, I had really just kind of, I was still healing, actually. And David comes up and gives me a bear hug around the back. And so, like, the wound started opening up and bleeding again.
Oh,
and I mean, it was like, can this thing please just heal? So, yeah, it stayed with me for a while. I mean, it was like a kind of a seminal part of my early 20s was dealing with that stuff.
Now, how long did Outsiders go for?
It went for 10 episodes, and the reason was
it was so much hype with that.
So much hype.
When
and
that,
you know,
thing came out.
I'll tell you, I mean, I have not always been the best behaved young man in my career, but I was like the best behaved guy in this set compared to these lunatics. I mean, they shut production down one time because of some of the shenanigans that these guys
pulled. Was it just like, hey, no, you know, they need us.
There was ego, but it was also some real bad behavior on the part of some of the guys.
Dude, it was all young guys.
I mean,
up and comers. Some of them were established.
Yeah.
It was just that time where it was freaking party. time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And was, and you know, we're and you know, I mean,
you're talking about the early 90s on Sunset Strip.
I mean, right. Right.
Come on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You were just a little baby.
It was
so was I, but I was on Brother Sean's back. I'm like, the, hey, where are we going tonight?
I'll never forget. We had a big party for the Outsiders on the Universal lot, and I'll never forget Billy Bob Thornton and I. It was night. Billy Bob Thornton and I stole a golf cart with like a case of beer from the party, and security's chasing us around the Psycho House.
That's amazing.
Oh, man.
Oh, I got some stories.
Yes, you do. And we could be here for 3 hours.
Right. So did you meet him before GH?
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. How did that happen?
You're so stupid.
Was it out of this world?
No.
How did we meet?
We met at an audition.
Did we really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't even remember.
And that's when we started kind of hanging out. You know, like, oh, yeah, you're nice kid.
You were living by the...
Is that 20-somethings talking about, like, hey, you're a nice kid. Let's go get
get off my lawn,
let's go get a milkshake, buddy.
No.
You were living by the
Beverly
Center.
They weren't milkshakes. That's for sure.
So you were living by the Beverly Center, remember?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And,
by the Beverly Center, and Sean, I don't know how it happened, dude. We just started hanging out. We had a lot in common, and we're just... Started hanging. He was like an older brother to me.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, hey, just, you know.
Steve and I spent a lot of time. We went to Malaysia together.
I've heard that story.
Oh, God.
Which one?
With our pet orangutan Moosley.
Oh, gosh. It was amazing. Dude.
I love that story. Is that, I'm not
well,
sure.
There's a few of them.
There's a few of them.
Are there any safe for public knowledge?
Not too many.
Okay. All right.
We'd have to kill you.
Yeah, right. Fair enough. I like
you'd
it.
You'd
right.
be dead afterwards. Right, but nothing. We hung out a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I kind of got introduced to the nightlife and how to kind of.
You like to. You I like the nightlife. You like to.
He likes to boogie.
I like to boogie. Sean, you know, it was always VIP everything.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, let's roll up, and I'm rolling either in the back door, which he did a lot, where we went, you know, he's knew everybody everywhere. So it was not like a normal introduction to go into all these hot spots that you couldn't even get in. We're rolling in the back, like through the kitchen.
Well, because how did Karate Kid 3 change your life? Like in terms of like how your day to day was like? Was it that? Like when it came out, was your life different?
It was different because I got recognized a lot.
Well, yeah.
It was different because I was suddenly able to get a lot of auditions that I couldn't get before. You know, the thing that looking back that I... is unfortunate for me is that, you know, because I had really just started acting, I got a lot of big auditions that I just really wasn't ready for. Mm. And I wish that I had gotten them later in my career, but you know, coulda, woulda, shoulda. I mean, we all have stories like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and, how else did it, I mean, it opened up a whole lot of, opportunities for me. It really did.
Yeah, and a lot of back doors to clubs.
Well, yeah. Well, because that was your first public thing, right? It wasn't.
Yes.
Right, and
sure.
So money. I'm not sure money wise it changed your life, but in terms of
it did. I mean, it changed my life in the sense that, you know, like I was a guy living in a 1-bedroom apartment above the whiskey.
Yeah.
And then I started making a couple bucks. I mean, I didn't get rich off Karate Kid.
Right.
But. You know, when you're 23 years old and you're running around Hollywood, how much money do you need?
Relative, right?
I mean, I had plenty of cash, and you know what I mean? We had fun.
Yes, we did.
Right.
We had fun.
Yes, we did. Sean showed me how to do a spinning back fist to a paper towel dispenser, and it shattered like John Woo, like a John Woo movie.
Your hand or the towel dispenser?
Well, he used his foot. I tried my hand. That didn't work too well.
I know. Here you are hanging out with a karate master, and I can imagine you did
definitely
a lot of,
not a karate master. Well, but I mean, come on.
But I imagine like you saw him do like a back or some sort of thing, and you're like, I can do that too.
Wait a second, Steve. Didn't you do a martial arts film? You did what's the one you did with Olivier Gruner? Didn't you do?
I did with Don Wilson.
Or maybe it's Don Wilson. What was it
Dragon.
Called?
Dragon. I did a few. Bad ones.
Did some martial arts,
yeah,
did
you? Yeah, a little bit. But,
okay.
But he was a true martial artist. I am not.
Well, sure.
I dabbled, but he is a martial artist. But, man, we had a lot of fun. He's always been kind of there. You know, when I did your podcast years ago, it was Sean was the first guy to really say, hey, you're starting to make some money now. You need to start taking care of this money. You need to start investing, put some aside. You need to look at this. You need to look at all the legal aspects of hey, now you're making some money.
Right. Yeah.
Don't be the hillbilly from Ohio that you are. Do something here.
Did I see that you were born in Ohio?
I was born in Ohio. Yes, I was born in Cleveland.
Same, like, you guys have that in common too, right?
So we're cousins by marriage.
Right.
Right.
I still am not sure how, but my mom tells me every time, so she knows how, and yeah. I'm sure Sean knows how on okay. some.
I have like a vague idea how.
But right. we found that out after we right, were on General right. Hospital
oh, that's
together.
That's funny.
Wait, here's a funny story. So Steve and I both auditioned for Bold and the Beautiful for the part of Thorn Forrester, and we were both so bad, they decided they weren't going to hire anybody. And we were both just terrible.
You turned us off to
and
the role.
I was like, wait, turn the lights back on. Wait.
That's amazing.
We screen tested.
We screen tested, yeah. yeah.
And you
yeah.
broke the screen.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and they said, wow, really bad acting.
And then years later, I wound up on right. Bold and the Beautiful.
That's
so.
Right.
And then we played Brothers on
right,
GH.
Right.
And I can't tell you how many times, I mean, I'm sure you never got recognized as me. I always got mistaken for him. They're like, you were Karate Kid 3 all the time.
That's
still
funny. That's
still
funny.
To this day.
Really?
Karate Kid 3.
You still do. Wow. I feel like I've been there a couple times. You know,
yeah.
And totally. I think Steve, yeah, when totally. Steve and I were younger, I think we looked even more alike.
Right. Oh, there's
I
mean, no doubt.
We both had the golden helmet.
Oh, it was beautiful. Sweet hair.
God, did we have a head of hair. It was just
sweet
gorgeous.
Hair.
It was glorious.
Looking. Yeah.
It was awesome. It was awesome. But, and then we got to, you know, we had a fun run on GH.
We did.
You know?
I love working with you. You know, we used to always say that, you know, when AJ and Jason couldn't talk to each other, Sean and Steve always could talk to each other. Mm. And I think our relationship off screen really...
100. There's no doubt about it.
No doubt. It really enhanced our
ability. We've spent so much time together before GH, mm-hmm. just years together.
Right.
Well, like, so who was on GH first?
Steve was.
Steve was. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Because Gerald Hopkins played AJ first,
right.
and then Sean came in.
Right.
But well, I mean, we spent so much time together, mm-hmm. dude.
Was that your first daytime role at GH?
Yes.
Okay. So what? Outsiders lasted for 10 episodes. Just people didn't watch it?
I don't remember what the rate. I mean, obviously, it wasn't good enough for them to
pick up.
You know, pick
guess,
up.
But,
right. And you know, the thing is, I did everything kind of backwards. I started doing this big studio film, and then I did the Outsiders.
Then you went to prime time, and then you're back.
Right.
Then you went to daytime.
Well, actually, you know what's funny is after I got done working for this Francis Ford Coppola series, I got hired by Oliver Stone, and I did a mini series called Wild Palms that Oliver Stone did, and I was like, Jesus, this is amazing, right?
Yeah.
And then I realized I really needed to work on myself as an actor, and so I took a play.
Oh, wow.
And I did a play for months at the now defunct Burbage Theater in L.A. And, you know, you've done a lot of theater, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, I love theater. It's my favorite thing to do. And you know that there's nothing like the growth that you experience as an actor over the rehearsal process and then the performance process of sink or swim. I mean, the curtain comes up and there's no cut and there's, you know, it's big boy time.
That's awesome.
that really helped me.
Yeah.
It is big boy time.
And then after the play, that's when I had the screen test for, which Steve was largely responsible for helping to put that together. And I was actually the only guy that screen tested. So I knew if I didn't get it, I really sucked. I was like, there's no one else here but me. I'm like, I better, you know. But I got to be honest. When I did that screen test, I couldn't help but feeling, I was like, Jesus Christ, we look so much alike. How can you not hire us as brothers?
Yeah,
I mean, it's like, it's ridiculous.
Right. Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
And where in the storyline did he come in? Was it around, like, what was, so Gerald had left or they wanted him to leave or whatever?
Yeah. So Gerald left and then at the time, Wendy Rich, it was, God bless his rest of soul, Luke Perry, but it was when 90210 was big.
And then
we started the young. It was me and Sean and
Antonio
Vanessa
and Vanessa.
And Antonio.
Oh,
and,
sure, yeah.
And you had the whole crew.
Right.
And we, you know, remember there was an edict when Wendy made everyone grow sideburns.
Oh, I remember that.
Do you remember? I couldn't.
Oh, no, I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah.
I remember I had them, though.
Yeah, she
I
wanted
had big
everyone,
chops.
After 90210, everyone had to grow sideburns.
Wow.
And then I couldn't because I was like
flannel shirts and sideburns.
Oh, dude, we had flannel shirts. We had jeans.
Man.
It was sweet.
That's amazing.
Well, that's that picture of the two of us where I'm sitting on the chair and we both have the flannel shirts with the sleeves cut off. And
but he, you know, he's the one who drove drunk and
hit your head in a rock.
Yeah. So I think that when I first came on the show, AJ was getting out of rehab. Yeah. I was getting out of rehab, and Monica and
man,
Alan
those were fun times. Like,
oh
man.
My God, they were really
the
really,
Quartermains, dude. All those Quartermain holidays we had. How much fun!
We had so much fun. And you're
talking about joking around and shutting sets down. They're like, "You idiots, will you focus?"
Steve and I had so much fun, and you know, we'd get the giggles, like you know, when you're in like fourth grade.
Oh yeah.
And it just sometimes we literally couldn't stop. I mean, it was just we'd have to walk away and just
dude,
take a breath.
Two muscle bound men just
yes.
giggling. It was just so much fun because we would bust each other's chops so much. God. And Stewart would bust our chops,
he would not let anything slide.
Yeah, he was very funny, but he was a big dude, and he'd be like, listen, you little bitches, why don't you shut up, and when you're in the business more than 5 minutes, call me. You know what I mean?
Gosh,
he totally would do that.
Yeah.
And then you have Anna Lee, who couldn't drive the chair, which I told the story before, but Sean's here, so every time we have a Quartermain in the Quartermain den, you know, they'd be like, Anna Lee is coming. Because her chair was different at work than at home. So she was like herky-jerky with it.
Yeah, yeah.
So she almost killed Leslie. You know, Leslie's not the biggest lady
in the
world. Right. And she's run over Leslie a few times.
Oh, my God.
It was just so much fun, dude. And David Lewis and Wally.
And John Engel. When John Engel came
on.
Steve and I were merciless with John Engel. We used to tease him so much.
Oh, we loved John Engel.
We loved John Engel. Yeah, we did.
Because he taught at Beverly Hills High
theater. Right, yeah.
And he left the year before I went to Beverly Hills High.
I see. Okay, yeah.
So he always jokes about that. Like, I would have been a better actor if he was still teaching.
That's funny.
But man, we just had a lot of fun, dude. We did so much.
Well, and those, I mean, that time at GH was a pretty special time too, right?
Yeah, it was kind of, I don't want to say it was the golden era, but we
it
had
was close though. I mean,
we had a good run.
I think the golden era was, you know, the early 80s of Luke and Laura.
Sure, yeah, sure.
But I think the early 90s with us and Antonio Sabato and everything, I think really
we had a good run. I mean,
had
run,
yeah.
You had Maurice come on, you had Stone, right. You had all these
I think we did a lot of important societal topics. You know, we dealt with
addiction.
We dealt with AIDS, we dealt with addiction.
Yeah, cancer, breast cancer.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot that we did and it was great. It was a great time because everything got its due. It wasn't, this story's bigger than everything else. They focused on the family, they focused on the hospital, they had the mob stuff, they had all this stuff going on together because Tony Geary was there all the time still. And it was just like, it was just a lot of fun, man. We had a good run, dude.
Yeah, we did.
We did. We really
When he hit his head and he became Jason Morgan, what did you think of his transformation? What did AJ think of it? And when Sean was like, "You bastard, you got a leather jacket now."
Oh my God, that's what I was just thinking. Yeah. I was like, you get to wear a leather jacket.
I'm still in these Quartermain sweaters, and you got to wear a leather jacket, you son of a.
Oh, I know. I think your part got a lot more interesting once you, because you were the good boy.
100%.
You know, I got to play the bad boy.
You had the best. You had the best part. I mean, AJ's a great character.
Well, sure,
he's a great character.
You know,
he's a great character. Yeah.
Well, I mean, his lineage is. Still lives on through Michael, and he's forever on the canvas, whether he's on it or not.
Yeah.
I wish we would have had the opportunity to work together again when I came back. I think that would have been really fun and special. But you know, it's how it goes.
Because you were gone already.
It is what it
or
is.
Or no?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm talking about when I came back for the 50th anniversary.
Right.
I wasn't there.
You were gone already. Yeah.
And then, so when did you? When did you get on Bold and Beautiful
I think I got on in 2001.
Oh, wow. That long ago.
So what were the first GH years?
92 to 97.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
And then a couple years of doing whatever and...
After I did General Hospital, I did some films and then I did Sunset Beach for a while.
Oh, that was another
Sunset Beach.
Was that a daytime show or was that a primetime soap?
Special agent Jude Kavanaugh.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Wait, that was Guza, right? I think Guza wrote Sunset Beach.
No, I think he wrote it. Yeah,
yeah.
I'm trying to remember what the Gary Tomlin was the producer. Yeah.
Yes, it's daytime. It was daytime.
It was daytime.
It was It was NBC.
NBC. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a spelling show.
Sunset Beach.
Right?
Wow.
Wow. And
I think I was on that for a couple of years.
Was that the life of the show? Was it like, did the show only last a couple of years?
I don't know.
No, you know what? It was already kind of tanking by the time I got on there. And I,
I
put the final nail in the coffin.
Yeah.
Bring Kanan on a show. He'll take it. Yeah.
That's amazing.
But then, and then B&B came along.
And then B&B came along, which was fantastic. I mean, that was, that really, along with Karate Kid, has been the biggest life-changing.
Really?
Yeah, because Bold and the Beautiful is the most syndicated show in television history, more than Baywatch. It's in the Guinness World Book of Records. And when I learned how big the show was in Italy, one of the few smart things I've done in my career was I learned to speak Italian.
Yeah, so when did you learn to speak Italian, before or after that?
I learned,
because I know you're a business man too.
I learned to speak Italian pretty soon after I started on the show. I started taking private lessons. I mean, I really, you know, I worked
because
really
because you saw there could be an opportunity in Italy.
And as luck would have it, I was hired to do a film in Italy where I played an Italian guy, and that was fantastic.
No way, dude. Yep. Are you serious?
Yep. And
so you're fluent in
I'm pretty close to fluent, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And so you can go there no problem, and
yeah, I mean, I do interviews in Italian. I mean, I
really,
you know, on TV and stuff like that. Yeah.
So dude, this guy, and, who knew he was so damn smart, right?
And I don't know about that, but
well, I do.
So I did this great movie, and we were at this beautiful place called Monte di Procida, which is about 30 minutes outside of Naples on the Amalfi Coast overlooking the Mediterranean. And I became very good friends with the hotel owner. He's one of my dearest friends now. And Michelle and I eventually went back and got married at this place.
Wow.
So that's one reason why my learning to speak Italian, transfer, you know, and then I was asked to do Dancing with the Stars in Italy. I did Bailando con le Stelle.
Ooh.
And then
so how long was that?
Well, it was a 15-week gig, but they put me up in Rome for like 6 months, and it was you do the math. Being single in Rome, starring on Dancing with the Stars, and starring on Bold and the Beautiful.
Yeah.
Was B&B 6 months ahead?
Like, yeah, oh, yeah, it was 6 months ahead. So,
wow.
Well, no, I had already been on for a couple of years. So, I mean, it was, I was.
Like, so you had to take a little bit of a break from Bold and the Beautiful to do it?
Took a break from Bold and the Beautiful. Okay. And I was the first guy from Bold and the Beautiful to go and do Dancing with the Stars. Now,
which is a big deal.
Now a couple of them have done it, but it was an exceptional experience.
FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box with full size. That's right, full-size beauty, fitness, fashion, and lifestyle products. It retails for $49.99, but always has a value over $200.
Full size. It makes my heart full size, because sample size products are such a tease. They make me so angry, because you get a little sample size, you think you like it. Oh my gosh, I really like this. But then you're nervous to use like a full dosage of it, because it's so small, you don't want it to go away. Full size gives you the experience that you want when you're trying new products. And FabFitFun, I mean, it's such a great service. It feels like it's your birthday four times a year when you get those subscription boxes.
Happy birthday.
Thanks, buddy. And each season's box features a variety of amazing quality brands like Tarte, Kate Somerville, Anthropologie, Free People, Dr. Brandt, and that's just the beginning of it. And don't miss out, because every season these boxes sell out fast.
That's right. So check out FabFitFun.com and use the code AWESOME10.
Awesome 10,
so you can save $10 off your first box, making it only $39.99. Again, that's FabFitFun.com, and use the code AWESOME10. Every car comes with its share of stories. That ding in your bumper when you nervously picked up a first date, the luxury package you got after a big promotion, or just the mileage you saved by riding your bike all summer. While you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with TrueCar, you can at least find out what your car's worth when it's time to sell it or trade it in.
Just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Then answer a few questions. Navigation and moonroof? Watch as they bump up your value. High mileage? You already knew it was going to cost you, but now you know how much it dings your wallet, so you can plan ahead. And once you're finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. True cash offer not available in all areas.
Now, let me ask you this, because everyone knows there's like urban legends in the soap world, right?
Uh-oh.
Listen, it has nothing to do with you.
Okay, good.
You're clear.
I'm clear, okay.
Ron Moss.
Yes.
So I don't know if this story is true, and you tell me this. This is what I've heard. This is the folklore, okay? Is that, is he when it's so big over there, Bold and Beautiful.
Yeah.
That when he landed at the airport, they had to shut the airport down.
Yeah, I fully believe that, and I'll tell you why. First of all, Bold and Beautiful, it's called Beautiful over there, is enormous. And Ron is huge. And I remember I was in Naples one day while I was filming that movie, and I was on Bold and Beautiful but took a break to film this movie. And I was on the main street called, I think it's called Via Roma in Naples, and I was at a store, and the store had a big glass window. And I noticed after about 10 minutes, there were a couple people looking, taking a picture.
Sure, yeah.
And then I looked back 5 minutes later, and there were 50 people. And then they locked the door to the store, and then there were 300 people, and they had to send the carabinieri in. And they were like, we can't take you outside right now. And I had to stay there for an hour. And they finally ushered me out the back. And this is not, oh, Sean Kanan's so fabulous and interesting. It's a function of the show is so sure. unbelievably big there.
Yeah.
That they go
so
nuts.
Supposedly the story goes that they landed, they shut the airport down. It's so big that he's here. It's complete chaos and mayhem.
I believe it.
So then they hang out with the elites of Italy,
sure.
and the diplomats and stuff. God, yeah. And Ron was supposed to fly back on the private jet the next day or the next evening or whatever. And a diplomat said to him, you need to stay for dinner.
Yeah.
And Ron's like, I can't. I got to go back to work. And they said, no, you're going to stay. We're going to give you $1 million to have dinner at this thing. I don't know if this is true or not.
Oh, I don't know about that. Maybe.
Okay.
But
where they're getting big fees over there back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
So, but anyway, the story goes that he called Bill Bell and was like, hey, I got to stay here for $1 million. He's like, okay, we'll see you. You have the day off.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I don't know.
That's amazing.
I believe it. I mean, I do believe it.
It could be. I wonder, it's a big deal.
Are the voiceover actors that dub your lines, are they famous too?
They're not famous, but they're called doppiatores. And the ones that do voiceover in Italy, it's like they're not actors, most of them. That's what they do,
yeah.
And they're highly respected. And I think they got the guy that did Maximus's voice in Gladiator to do my voice. So I had this badass voice. And
well, because then the story goes also that because the guy who did
Ron's voice
was a deep voice.
Yeah.
And then Ron gets over there and goes, hey, everybody. And they're like,
he doesn't sound like Michael Jackson.
No,
come on.
No, but his voice was higher than the TV voice. And people were like, you could hear, someone said you could hear a pin drop. They're
oh
like,
my God.
They don't listen to Player over in Italy?
Hey, Ron is touring Europe right now, killing it,
oh,
doing Baby,
I'm sure he
baby
is.
Come Back. He's a great guy. I don't know if do you guys know him?
I know Ron, yeah.
Ron is
a
really, really terrific guy.
Yeah,
for sure. Like him.
There's no doubt. But I just love hearing all those crazy stories.
And the guy, I'm convinced he drinks like blood of virgins or something because he's like, I don't know how old, and he's like yoked, just ripped,
he's
nine pack. I mean,
yeah, I know.
He's got like this black mane.
I know, the hair is
like
amazing.
A gorgeous chinchilla on his head. He probably wears a cape sometimes.
And a scarf.
Well, Ron likes a scarf.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Well, the secret of life is stored in his dimples, I think.
So you,
I believe that.
You played Deacon, is that correct?
I played Deacon Sharp, yeah.
And then you crossed over to Y&R a little bit, too.
Yeah, and I played Deacon Sharp on Y&R, too. So
wow.
I'm one of the few characters to do a crossover, which was
That's cool,
was
man.
Fun, yeah. Great character, a lot of fun.
That's great.
Well, they're just across the hall, right?
They are exactly across the hall.
Right across the hall, sir.
Yeah, because, but our, what are the towns?
And right next to Wheel of Fortune. No, not Wheel of Fortune. I'm sorry. Price is Right.
Price is Right.
Price
yeah.
is Right. So you always see the prizes out in the
through,
hallway.
Yeah, cutting through.
You always see the games and stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Is Genoa City near to?
No, nowhere near.
It's in Wisconsin.
Right. In Bold and the Beautiful's?
In L.A.
L.A.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do those worlds connect?
I think I got taken in a plane by Don Diamont's character. And then he let me off in Wisconsin.
Wow, that's amazing.
And then there I was.
He just dropped you off right there.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
You got to love the soaps, man.
That's crazy. So besides the acting, I know, because we could talk about that all day long, but you've always been an entrepreneur because you always had real estate for as long as I've known mm-hmm. you. You've had some other businesses.
Right.
You've always produced movies, mm-hmm. you've written, you've directed stuff. You're really a go-getter. Have you always been that way? Kind of like goal-oriented, or you get an idea and you're like, hey, I'm going to go do this? Or
I think so. You know, unless you're the Brad Pitts and the Tom Cruises of our business, you're really another actor waiting to get hired.
Right.
And it's really frustrating for me to have my future being determined by other people.
Absolutely.
And so I try my best to create other opportunities for myself. And, you know, sometimes they work out and other times they don't. But I keep, you know, it's what do they say about that little mouse that's in the milk, and it's, he keeps going until it becomes cream and walks out. So that's kind of me, I guess.
Have you, cause I obviously you have a book that's about to come out, but you've written other books.
Yeah.
I wrote
another book called The Modern Gentleman.
Did that just come out of like, I have all this information, I need to share it, or I just feel like writing a book, or where did that come from?
You know, I pitched a couple ideas to a publisher, and that's the idea that they wanted to go with. And sometimes I can procrastinate. And so I said, look, I'll do this book, but here's the deal. I have to contractually be bound to give you a manuscript in 30 days. And he said, nobody writes a book in 30 days. And I said, I'm going to write it in 30 days because otherwise it ain't getting written. And so I locked myself in a room and just wrote this thing. And it's kind of a hybrid book. The book is, it's a cookbook, but it also has a number of chapters, and it's to help guys, I think, become better guys, and to give women some insight into how we think. And so there's a lot of chapters in it, like The Modern Gentleman Learns a Language. And I talk about how learning a language has really helped me in my life, or The Modern Gentleman Defends Himself. And I talk about how, you know, studying martial arts has been a hugely impactful thing on me. And then there's a lot of chapters about, you know, when I was living in Italy and some of my adventures over there and things like that. And it's very sort of cheeky and funny and does not take itself too seriously. And it's a fun read.
Yeah.
That was a really good experience doing that.
Yeah. So it was that part of what Steve said, your kind of entrepreneurial spirit, or was it an opportunity that came to you, or was it just?
I've always loved writing. I've written for as long as I can remember. You know, I wrote a film that Lionsgate distributed called Chasing Holden, which was about a young kid who runs away from boarding school to find J.D. Salinger. And the genesis of that project was I went to boarding school and was very difficult, lonely time.
Yeah.
High school?
My last 2 years of high school.
Wow.
And I kept a journal from time to time, and I stumbled across this journal once I was out here in LA, and I read a few passages, and that was the impetus for me turning that into a film. So I've always loved to write.
Yeah.
You know, my issue is I don't have the monastic sensibility of being able to write every single day diligently, like, you know, right. You know, they say a writer writes always. I write in spurts.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, but it's something that I love doing. And I think, you know, you guys know this as actors, if you have the ability to create dialogue and write, you can take what would maybe be a B performance to at least a B plus or an A minus. If you're able to tweak your lines and do stuff like that. And I think I've done 15 films now. And I think in at least five or six of them, I've had a significant role in writing the films and the dialogue.
Yeah.
Pretty much out of self-preservation and selfishness of wanting to make my role better.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, because, I mean, part of acting is understanding the language and understanding what your character is wanting and needing to say.
Right.
And sometimes once you figure that out, what the character is trying to say, the words can come to you in a more organic way.
Absolutely.
And so it's just connecting to the truthfulness of the character. And because the words don't have to be complicated. Sometimes the best dialogue is not complicated.
Absolutely.
Right? So that, you know, I think that is part of, you know, any good actor's toolbox is figuring out how to say what needs to be said.
Right.
And, you know, and it's not about ego, right? It's not about,
no,
I need to change this because, but it's about just understanding what.
Yeah, it's obviously you're not, you know, keeping the intent of what's being written and respecting the writer. I mean, I'm all for respecting the writer, but for instance, when we work on soaps, it's such a voluminous amount of material that sometimes, and I know you guys know this, you know, there's certain words that don't come out of your mouth easily.
Totally.
And you got to figure out a way to say them. And the other thing is, we're saying the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
So when somebody misses Friday and they tune in Monday, they know what's being said. So the challenge, people always say, oh, isn't it hard learning all that dialogue? Well, Yeah, it is, but that's not the most difficult thing. The challenge is, how do I take the same thing I'm saying over and over again and make it relevant for the sixth time?
Exactly. As we just talked about that last episode is, you know, about pacing yourself.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Because you know that you're going to have the same scene maybe seven times between the beginning of the story and the end of the story.
Right.
So it's like you can't go... You can't be on level 10 when you do it the first time. You got to pace yourself.
Yes.
You got to change it up. I just saw that I have a scene. I say the exact same thing in this scene that I said three times already. And I'm like, I got to figure out how to kind of just tweak it. And
you know, sometimes I would literally laugh at myself repeating something. You know, that was a choice I would make. Like, here I go. Am I saying this again? And, you know, just kind of as the character, self-reflectively laugh at myself.
Sure.
Because you got to come up with something, right?
I can't do that. Jason doesn't laugh. So, so I'm going to have to figure something else out. Maybe just not say it.
Right. Well, because sometimes also, I'm not sure if it's, you know, individual script writers that kind of, you know, fall in love with turn of phrases, like certain phrases, like
I have a newsflash for you.
Yeah. I was just going to say that.
Or off the rails.
Yeah.
Or going off the rails. I have a newsflash for you. Yeah.
So, and I'm not sure if that is, if that's certain script writers or if like a team of writers all of a sudden sees it in someone else's script. They're like, oh, I like how that sounds. Like, I don't know but it happens a lot in our scripts where you'll get these just little phrases that
pop up consistently.
That three or four people say.
So it's funny because you'll be doing a scene and it comes up again and you're like, I gotta figure out what they're trying to say,
right?
And I gotta find something else to say because this is just
I know, it's interesting.
So
are you writing anything else now?
I'm working on a really exciting project right now.
Are you?
It's a 30 minute single camera dramedy called The Bubble. And
like a series.
I was hired to write this, and so we are in the process of completing 8 episodes, and we're going to be filming it this year. And it's about a guy who's an aging soap star that has lived in the golden cage of daytime, the bubble,
right?
And he's having a bit of a midlife crisis, and his biggest fear is that he's kind of mediocre.
Yeah.
And he wants to do more, and more comes in the form of a daughter that he never knew he had.
Oh wow!
And
it's actually really great.
I read it.
Steve,
yeah. Oh yeah.
Read it,
yeah.
So, yeah,
it's really good. Yeah. Anything relatable in there?
Sure. Everything he just said, Dick. Oh, you're going to get a spitting back right in your little jackal face. I'm going to rip that little jackal face.
I know I was stone cold, but how did the jackal come?
Look at him. Look, it's like a little hyena trying to freaking grab onto my leg. Freaking bite me.
I love
it. You saw our whole coffee thing in there.
Yeah.
There's freaking the jackals everywhere.
You guys are like, you're married, though.
Yeah, we've been on the road a lot.
Yeah,
so.
That'll do it, man. That'll do it. There's nothing like the road.
The road does marry you. It marries you.
Oh, my God. Well, Steve, you and I used to go on the road a lot, too.
Oh, gosh.
You guys hit every mall in America, right?
We hit a lot of places.
I still think we have an outstanding warrant in Key West.
One of us does. One of us does. You know, we shouldn't have been swimming in that freaking gator pit, though. That's one thing I know.
Man.
I know we should have been jumping in there at about 4 a.m.
We had some fun.
Gator pits in Key West?
Yeah. Well, there's gators in the little...
Okay.
In the little canals.
Oh, yeah.
You got to be careful, my friend.
Oh, I thought Key West was more of an ocean.
Well, we actually had a place that was like 15 miles outside of Key West.
Yeah, but it was still kind of on the water, in the waterways, so you just
times.
Never know.
Yeah, it was me, Steve, Cheatwood.
Oh, man.
You know?
Yeah,
it just sounds terrible.
What's Dirk's character he plays on?
Max.
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 Yeah, so imagine AJ Max and Jason slash...
Jason. I know, it was crazy. That was a crazy trip.
Yeah, it was fun.
So this current book, where did that
come from? Tell us about this
book,
man.
About 15 years ago, my writing partner, Jill Lieberman, asked me to be in a book called American Pride. And it was a bunch of celebrities, and they were talking about what America meant to them. And so smash cut, 15 years later, about a year ago, Jill calls me up to wish me happy birthday. And by the time we got off the phone, we were writing partners. I had an idea to do something that would act a bit as a conduit or a bridge towards facilitating a less divisive dialogue with what's going on right now in our country.
Sure.
And I was like, what's something that nobody can be against is the pursuit of success. I mean, we all want success for ourselves. We want it for our children. You know, I think that there's probably like four or five pillars of life that lead to happiness. I think one is, you know, being successful at your chosen occupation. One is the quality of our relationships.
Yeah.
You know, being happy with yourself. And so we decided to write this book. And, you know, I've lived in Hollywood. We say Hollywood no matter where you live in LA.
I know, it's so funny, right?
But you know, for 30 years plus, and so I know a fair amount of people, and Jill knows a fair amount of people too, and so we reached out to a really diverse group of people.
Yeah.
And we wanted to get their best advice about success.
Yeah.
And we got everybody from the first female billionaire, Sarah Blakely, to Mark Cuban, to Anthony Robbins, to Run DMC, Daryl McDaniels, famous baseball players, football players, Jason Alexander, Steve is in it, Susan Lucci, other people from daytime, Tristan Rogers, Kimberlyn Brown, Kate Linder, Jennifer Finnegan. And all of these people came together and they wrote these beautiful, interesting testimonials about success.
Yeah.
And the thing that I was looking for was, on a personal level, is I wanted to see what the common denominator was.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, my acting teacher, the late Roy London, used to always say, I've got more in common with a successful plumber than with an unsuccessful acting teacher. Mm. And by that, he means success leaves clues. Some of the very things that it takes to be successful in any chosen field appear in other chosen fields.
Sure.
And almost to an individual, the people in the book didn't talk about success in terms of external trappings, power, things like that. There's people that have a lot of that in book.
Yeah.
But they talked about having the ability to inspire people, which is sort of a personal mission for me. You know, being of service is really important. Steve, you talk about that. Being of service is critically important, I think, to having a good life. And they talk about having sort of an internal barometer that dictates what success is to you. And when you meet that internal barometer and you feel that sense of success, it doesn't matter what anyone else's perception of success is. You've met your own sense of success, and that's true success.
Right. I mean, people that seek the validation of other people's admiration.
Right.
That you'll never get enough of that. That's not something.
No, it's an endless hole.
That's not something that you finally get and you're like, it comes from inside. It comes from, you know.
Yeah. And so I think there's some really, really incredible, advice in this book. And, I really hope that people will get the book because it's the kind of thing you can go back to again and again and take a look at.
And it's never, and not to cut you off, Sean, but it's never too late.
No.
Right.
It's not.
It's never too late to change or to have aspirations or goals. Right. And I think that's what one of the biggest things for me, learning just this last, you know, leaving GH, going to YNR, but I had a lot of time to work on myself.
Right. It's critical.
And shake, just do something new.
Right.
You know, I got to listen and read a lot of books on those flights and just try to become just better.
Just shove good stuff into your head.
Yeah.
Good head food.
Yeah. And it's never too late, though.
It's not. And, you know, to that end, I'll tell you something. One of my goals this year was to read a lot more than I have in the past. And so I just finished this book by a guy named Hal Elrod, and the book is called The Morning Miracle. And what he talks about in it is the incredible way that you can change your day by waking up really early in the morning. And he talks about doing these six things called the savers, he calls them. So S is intentional silence. You know, you sit in silence for a couple minutes, whether you're praying, whether you're just getting in touch and centering yourself.
Yeah.
A is daily affirmations. And what I do is I go on my iPad, I throw my headphones on, and I listen to 5 or 6 minutes of, you know, success-based or love-based or whatever-based daily affirmations. Then visualization. Visualize what your day is going to be. Mm. E is exercise. R is reading. And you know, for me, I read 20 pages of a book every day. And the thing is, one thing I've learned is the power of accumulation, in the sense that it's like compound interest on a loan. Yeah. You read 20 pages a day. Yeah. At the end of a year, you've read almost 7,000 pages of a book. And then the last is S for scribe, which is writing.
Yeah.
And so for me, the writing is not really a problem because it's something I do. So I've been getting up at like 5:30 in the morning, and it's crazy because I was never a morning person.
Yeah.
And I hit the ground running. I cannot wait to start my day. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is something I've just started doing at 52 years old.
Yeah.
You know, and I wish I would have done this when we were kids.
What time do you go to bed?
You know, I used to stay up really late.
Yeah.
And now I'm pretty much, you know, most of the time I'm sacked out by 11 o'clock.
Okay.
You know,
still getting up at 5:30. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if I stay up late, I'll get up maybe at 7:30.
Yeah.
But every single day, I've been going through this morning ritual.
Starting your day with that.
Yeah. if you talk to most really successful people, they say that one of the things that really differentiates super successful people from mediocrity is they have a morning ritual.
Yes.
Now, if you can't do it in the morning, say you work the graveyard shift of a job,
sure.
You don't do it in the morning, obviously, because right. You're sleeping, but you take that half an hour to an hour of your time and center yourself, and it completely changes the trajectory of your day. I've had
100%
so much crazy, good, positive stuff happen in this last week.
Yeah.
You know, in preparation for the book and everything, I've really, you know, if you make a list at the end of the day of everything you've achieved, sometimes, you know, you're in the blood feud and you're doing it.
Right.
And if you take a second and chill out and go, I did this, 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 and this, you're like, wow.
Yeah.
And it's that accumulation. It's over the course of a year of having days like that. You're not going to have every day like that. And you're going to have alligators. You got to slay, and you're going to have curveballs.
Yeah, you're
going
to have days you get up. You're not going to be able to do your morning ritual, or your habit, or your workout, or whatever it is. And you know, but it's the routine that will get you the success in the end, right? Because we're all going to have our days where you don't feel like doing anything. And that's what I try to tell people with the nutrition and exercise. If you just do the routine will get you to the next step where then you'll feel motivated again.
Right?
Then you'll feel like, oh, I did it. I mean, there's
nobody ever leaves the gym feeling bad.
There's an affirmation though.
Yeah.
I did it.
Yeah,
I didn't want to do it and I did it, you know,
and
that's building
so
your self-confidence, and that's letting you get up the next day and do it again. But for me, the biggest thing, Sean, and it was taking control of my day.
Absolutely.
Not letting the day take control of me.
Dead on.
In the beginning. And I was, for years, the day would take control of it.
I think a really good strategy, you know, you have tactics and strategies.
Sure.
Okay. And I think a really good tactic to achieving what you just said is the power of no. And you really have got to be able to say no to things that are, you know, no to things and people. You know, one of the things, I'm working on a new book, and I have a chapter called Thieves of Time and Emotional Vampires. And
is that about the iPhone?
Right, because that's it.
Because you got to say no to your phone.
You got to say no to your phone sometimes. I know, and that's the hardest thing to do because we're all so connected into it, and it's such an amazing tool.
Right.
But you know, that's one of the reasons I really like doing my reading in the morning because it's put that away. But part of taking control of your day is the ability to not do certain things. And sometimes you can't do everything that other people want you to do.
Right.
And you learn to work smarter, I think.
Yeah.
So the book's called Success Factor.
It's called Success Factor X.
Success Factor X.
It's available for pre-order right now.
Pre-order right now.
You can get it on Amazon right now for pre-order. And
is there a website?
There is a website, which is successfactorxbook.com.
Cool.
And we're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. If everyone would follow, that would be great because we're trying to build up our community.
Yeah.
And if you go on the website, you're going to see we've got a bunch of book signings coming up, and we would love everyone to come out and be a part of it.
Nice, man.
Yeah. I want to go to the Grove, me and you,
dude,
buddy.
Yeah, we're working on that.
Okay, cool. That'd be awesome.
Absolutely working on that.
I would love that. That's
for sure.
Amazing. Yeah,
for
I did.
Sure.
And, you know, because Sean asked me to be in this book, and I kind of ducked him for a while. I did.
I was relentless, man. I knew Steve needed to do this, and I wasn't going to not let him do it.
Well done.
Well, but you know what, dude? For me, it's interesting because it was a time for me, Sean, where you were asking me to be in this book. And look, I've had a lot of successes and I've had a lot of failures.
Sure.
As you probably have
business-wise.
And the hardest cliche to live by is that you learn from your failures.
Right.
That's the hardest thing. Honestly, that's the most challenging thing I've ever had to, not ever had to deal with, but like, you know, with this restaurant that I just had in Tennessee, it failed, essentially. Mm-hmm. It failed. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could blame things. You can say it was this or that. But the bottom line is it failed.
Yeah.
You know, and it was very, very difficult.
Emotionally,
for me, emotionally, financially, to come to grips with that.
Right.
It was a struggle for me. And then you were asking me to be...
And you felt like possibly by doing it, you'd feel like a fraud?
I just felt like, why would I, you know, why should I do this when this just failed? You know what I mean?
I completely get that. And a lot of people say to me, why you? Why are you a guy writing a book about success? And clearly there are individuals in this book that are light years beyond me with success. Sure. But for me, I kind of consider myself, and I know you too, Steve, a student of success.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to do this book as a way of encapsulizing a lot of the things that I've learned.
You're curating things that are inspiring to you.
Absolutely.
And you people that are inspiring to you.
And right? Jill and I don't say that we wrote this book. This book was written by Steve. This book was written by Mark.
Sure.
This book was written by the amazing people that agreed to do it. I've written parts of this book for sure. But, I don't say that Jill and I authored this book.
Right.
But to your end, Steve, you've got so much to share about success. And I completely understand what you're saying. And I'm so glad that you did decide to do it because your submission was terrific. And there were things about you that I didn't know. I mean, I love the story about your grandfather being a door-to-door salesman and how he would have you at a young age writing down your goals.
Writing down my goals.
And I mean, that's tremendous information for people.
I know.
And so you're going to help people with what you wrote.
Yeah, I hope so. I just appreciate the fact that you are relentless because I was able to come out of the muck of dealing with it and you know, obviously moving forward and putting it behind you and cutting your losses and, you know, you gotta move forward.
You do.
There's just no other way about it.
Yeah.
But then mentally you got to get right. But the timing of you coming back and saying, hey, it was a time where I'm like, okay, shedding this old freaking skin this last year, and now I can see again.
Yeah.
You know, so I appreciate you.
That's a really cool exercise.
Man, it's a tough one, dude.
Getting out of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just saying it's a tough one, and people don't. You know, this is why I love doing the podcast is because you can be real about things that affect people also. Because I know there's a ton of people who have had failed businesses, failed relationships, failed whatever. But you have to get up and keep going every day, and when you say learn from it, I know what I'll never do again.
Right.
Sure.
Right. So I can actually look at things with more of a positive a way of looking at as opposed to a negative. Right. So.
One of the things that I think I'm guessing here, but I think some people look at success books and go, oh, well, you know what? I know what my career is. I'm this age. I know what the rest of my life is going to look like. I don't need a book like that. Mm. But the thing is, what I've realized in my, you know, I know what I'm, I know what my, how my life is structured. I know what I think I want. I know I have but it's not, success doesn't have to be 100% career, right?
No, absolutely not.
You can be, or money.
Right. It's
relationships are incredibly important.
Right. So it's sometimes that word success, I think some people don't even think that applies to them because, I'm not in a situation where that word is in my vocabulary.
I think everybody, you know, you said you know what you want out of life and you think you have your life plotted out. And one of the things that I talk about in my submission is, yes, have a plan. That's imperative, but plan for contingencies. There's this great quote by Mike Tyson that I love. Everybody's got a plan till they get hit in the mouth. Okay. And you've got to be able to bite some ears. You got to be able to bite some ears.
Hey, he had a contingency.
He had a contingency, man.
He had a contingency plan. It's a good. You make a good point about the success part of it because people think, oh, if you have money in this house, you're successful.
Right.
Guess what? 99 out of 100 of those guys
aren't happy.
Aren't happy.
Right.
Right. Are you a successful husband, dad?
Yeah.
Is that where your fulfillment is? Or with your friends, your relationships? Listen, when it comes down to it, relationships.
Yeah.
Is all we really have
Absolutely.
At the end of the day, right? And it's just such a great subject that's so enriching for people and it's just so much to learn.
For me, and I've been fortunate. I've had some nice successes in my life. And like Steve, like you, I've had some cataclysmic failures. And some of them it's taken me a while to learn from.
Sure.
But one of the things that I have so far been really successful with, which is a source of pride for me and definitely a success, is my marriage to Michelle. And, you know, I had an initial marriage that wound up in divorce, and it was crushing that it wound up in divorce. But had that not happened, it wouldn't have brought me to my soulmate, to the person who is, you know, everything and has helped me to become a guy that I simply couldn't become back then.
Yeah,
and for
yeah.
me, that's a huge success. It's Absolutely. It's not just about, am I on a show? Am I making money? No. Those things are great. And those are successes.
Right.
And listen, when you have lots and lots of money coming in, if you're, I think, a good person, it facilitates the ability to help other people 100%. Achieve a lot of the stuff.
Yeah.
But as important as that is to me, I would have to say that it's no longer the most important thing. And a corollary to that is, when it's no longer the most important thing to you, is when it comes to you.
Mm. That's true.
Yeah.
You know?
When you're not chasing it.
When you're not chasing the dragon, you know?
Trust me. I've been the dragon chaser
yeah.
for a long time.
Well, when you focus on, I mean, I think that word success, in order to have what you can consider success, you first need a goal of some sort. And that's right. one thing I didn't have for a while. I was like, I'm fine without goals. But goals don't have to be lofty. Goals can be being a more present father,
yes.
a better partner. You know, it can be anything. And therefore, success is attainable to anyone as long as you want to do something for yourself or for others.
You know,
right?
you make a good point. And, you know, if anyone's listening to this and you're going through a tough time in your life and you feel like you need a win, you know, set a goal for yourself that is absolutely attainable and only requires you to do what is necessary. And I mean, it could be something as silly as, gosh, I haven't been able to get out of bed for 2 days. And today I'm going to go put my shoes on and I'm going to take a walk in the park and I'm going to feel some sun in my face and get some vitamin D.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get out of my cave.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a win.
That
totally.
Is.
Give yourself a win and then move on from there.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
and that's where your compounding interest.
Yes.
Metaphor comes yeah. back in, because those little ones, all of a sudden,
add up.
You got 10 wins.
Yes.
And yeah. now guess what? You're feeling yeah. good. You're getting yeah. some self-esteem back.
Absolutely.
And it's super important for people, you know, to set goals that are attainable, because you can always have
your macro goals, you know.
You got to have the micro steps
yeah.
to get there,
sure.
you know. So,
for sure.
But I just think it's such an interesting topic, especially I've been really studying it and reading about it the last 5 years extensively, because, you know, you have to grow. If you're not yeah. growing, you're going backwards.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing that I've learned in doing this book is that you can have talent. I think the three of us are fortunate that we're blessed with talent. And there's a lot of talented guys out there that are washing dishes. And there's nothing wrong with washing dishes, but it ain't what I aspire to.
100%.
And the point that I'm saying is, talent without action, talent without the commitment and discipline to achieve your goals is really sad, because it's wasted. And the lesson that I've learned is, it takes putting the work in.
Thank you.
And for a very long time in my career, you know, I relied on having talent and didn't necessarily work as hard as I should have.
Yeah,
and
sure.
now, you know, when this book really started to gel and come to fruition, I had kind of a talk with myself, and I was like, look, buddy, if you're going to, you know, put your face and your stamp on a book about success, you better walk it like you talk it.
Yeah. Sure,
because
sure.
otherwise you are a fraud. And I made some monumental changes in my life. And I kind of, for a long time, I really sort of prayed to God, the universe, whatever, and was like, please give me the ability to fulfill the commitments that I need to fulfill and have the discipline to do what I want to do. And it sort of just started to happen.
Yeah. First of all, I know you're not a fraud, because I've known you for a long time, and I know your work ethic, and you're being a little hard on yourself, which is fine, because sometimes you have to be anyway.
Right.
Because you came into my life in a time where I needed guidance, you know, and Sean was there for me to kind of just mentor me and be a big brother to me and watch out for me and kind of steer me in the right directions in life that were important at that time for
yeah.
me. So, you know, I appreciate that, man. I'm so grateful to be involved in this.
And we're grateful
book.
To have you.
I'm so excited about this book. I can't wait to do the book signings and help you promote this thing.
Excellent.
Because, It's just something that's really dear to me. So thank you. And
you guys, thank you both.
Sean, this thanks for awesome, man. We had so much honor. Fun, dude.
I love chatting with you guys.
Yes, man. This is great amazing. To see you. Great
so
to see you.
The book again is called Success Factor X.
Yes.
And you're on social. You're at.
I'm at Sean Kanan on Twitter, Sean Kanan on Instagram, and then it's Success Factor X Book is the website, the Facebook, and the Twitter, and then it's Success Factor X on Instagram.
And you can find awesome. It on Amazon. Yes. So go order this thing, thank man. You. The yes. stuff you can learn from people, the wisdom that you get from guys like Buffett and Tony Rock, all these guys, man, it's just amazing.
Let me just say one thing that just truth in advertising. Warren Buffett was supposed to be in the book, and at the last minute, we weren't able to work something out. So unfortunately, he is not in the book. But I do want to say that a portion of the profits are going to the American Red Cross. They do amazing work in every corner of the earth in times of disaster. And so please pick up the book.
Yeah, that's
good
great.
Thing.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Cool.
Thank you so
thanks,
much.
Thanks, Sean. Sean Kanan.
Yeah. Hey, man. That was awesome.
Yeah, it's always great to see Sean, man. I just love catching up with him. It is like a family reunion when he and I get together because obviously we played brothers on the show, but we were related by marriage that we found out, which is crazy, right?
These people that are married that made you and Sean relatives.
Yeah.
Have you met these people?
No.
No.
No idea. My mom and his parents know everybody. We don't even kind of know what's going on.
Sure. Do you guys ever go back and visit those Ohio folk?
There's not many Ohio folk left to visit.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So Indiana, I got some family in Indiana still, but, I don't really get back there often. So,
yeah. Well, we're going to just have to plan a tour so that
that's
Steve
right, buddy.
Can go visit some family.
Woo.
We can do a backyard Stone Cold and the Jacko show for the Bertonians.
That's right, buddy.
Yeah, it'd be amazing.
Be great.
Yeah, a little backyard barbecue for Steve's family. That'd be great.
Get some moonshine.
Dude, I would love it. I would love every second of it.
I know you would.
Yeah. So that was great. Sean, yes. You know, Sean, I crossed paths with him, but he's just a really thoughtful, generous, just really present fellow.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when you're looking in his eyes, you know, he's with you.
Yeah.
And that's really cool. You know,
it's cool. You know, and he was a big, he did have a great influence on me when I was younger. So, without his guidance, I don't know, man, I just really started to pay attention to things with his guidance, which was great. So,
cool.
and it just, it kind of, it's going full circle with this book that he's doing.
Yeah.
Which makes a lot of sense because he was always very smart financially. He was always an entrepreneur. He was always a hardworking guy. So the book just makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, the website for that is successfactorxbook.com.
Yes.
.com.
So thank you, Sean, for involving me and go pre-order your book.
Yeah. Not only great other voices of inspiration and success, but if you want more of Steve, there you go.
Hey, and if you don't, too bad.
Too bad. Well, you can skip that chapter. How about that?
You can skip that page.
Yeah. Well, it's also another big thing this week. Baseball season started up.
Baseball.
Happy freaking opening week. I got a little Stone Cold and Jacko baseball shirt on.
Look at that.
Yeah.
We should put numbers on the back.
We just have our. Oh,
wouldn't
right.
that be cool?
I should.
But that would be cool. Oh, that'd be cool though if we could put a number on there.
I know. What would I be?
A negative one.
You're number one. You're number one.
No, negative
you're number one. You're number one. I'd just be like 0.5.
Yeah, it'd have to be something like
half.
You
a
would
man.
Actually. You'd be pie.
That would be great.
Just the pie signal. Like there's a pie signal. Just the pie sign would be great, wouldn't it?
I love that. That's genius.
What is? Do you know what pi is, buddy?
3.14 to infinity. That one.
There you go.
Yeah. Thank you. Oh, did you see big news in the science community? The person that the person calculated pi to like the billionth or something like that. It's just nuts. But I mean, if you know it goes on for infinity, like who cares?
Isn't the word infinity enough?
I know,
to,
right?
To just, not Have you tried to figure it out?
I know. I don't know what like it doesn't. I don't know what you're reaching for. Like,
yeah,
what's enough? What's enough?
That's funny because they just had Pi Day at school.
Oh, March 14th, right? Yeah.
So you had to, you know, Jack made a T-shirt, and you know all these kids wore these little witty, Brainiac Pi T-shirts.
That's great.
Yeah, it was great.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And then St. Patrick's Day is a few days later, and everyone loses their mind. It's great.
Yeah.
Work totally. Your mind really hard and then douse it and, on St. Patrick's
douse
Day.
It, right.
Yeah. So this week we are going to answer our first video question.
Yeah, this is new for us, right?
Right. A few weeks ago we had said, hey, if you have a question, send us a video of you asking that question. We'll answer the question on the podcast, and then we'll include your video with our video on our little Facebook video recap that we do most Fridays. Some podcasts we don't get video of because of where we are and whatnot, but we try to. And we're going to include some listener video questions in those. So our first contestant is Kathy Hedrick.
Contestant, dude.
I know. It sounded like it sounded like the right thing to say.
Show?
No, I know. There are no prizes except that you get to be in a video with us for better or for worse. So
is that your final answer?
Yeah.
Is that your final answer?
So our question this week comes from Kathy Hedrick. Thank you, Kathy. Thank you for being the trailblazer here. She was the first one to send us a video question, and so far she's the only.
We got one.
Yeah, so get on it, people, because this is fun. This is fun for us. Yes, we'll send you a baseball shirt with your number one on it. Get on it, people, because this is fun. This is fun. I'm having fun. Steve's having fun. And it'll remain to be seen if you guys are having fun. But Kathy says,
hi, guys. My name's Kathy Hedrick. My question is, can GH go back to a different taping schedule? Where you don't have as much to do one day, where you're not as rushed, and would you want them to?
Kathy, that's a great question. We do actually talk about how much material we do weekly now because we do get anywhere from 18 to 20 weeks off, which is amazing. So we do that to obviously save money. That's why we go dark all those weeks. I don't know if that could change or not, but we're kind of used to being in this routine of having to do so much material. I think people actually would prefer doing this and having those weeks off, especially, you know, me and Bradford.
Yeah, I mean, without those weeks off, we wouldn't be able to go out and visit folks as much as we do.
So we have a lot of fun on the road. So I don't mind it. It gets a little hectic, but, you know, I don't think they could go back to it, or they would. Because it gives people a little bit of a break to clear the head and see their family and relax and
I don't think the production team thinks of this as like the best case scenario. This feels like, oh, this is what we have to do. This is not what we choose to do in terms of scheduling the way they schedule.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, and production and everybody's still here too. Production's still here. All you know, producers and everybody comes in and they're still, you know, there's a lot of prep work.
They're here. They're here on the weeks off. You mean?
Correct.
Yeah.
So, but it is a way to save money and it works.
Yeah. Ultimately when it comes to making a TV show that's on air, quality is, you know, everybody wants, but the bottom line is it profitable? And the more profitable it is, the more likely it's going to stay
Going to stay. And since we're at 56 years, let's go another 56 more.
Right. So, but if we could slow it down a bit and still have the same profitability,
sure.
That would be awesome. But if we're going to do a daily show that's on every day, then I don't think there's any way to do it any other way.
No, I mean, you know, it's kind of I don't want to say it's across the board in daytime, but I know Days has a similar, even more stringent schedule than we do.
Yeah.
They're done. I don't know what time it is, but every day they're done at a certain time.
Yeah.
So they get all their stuff done, and that's what they have to do, and it works,
and
you know.
And they get so far ahead. Do they not take as much time off as we do?
They take the same amount of time, if not more. But I think they've been so far ahead.
Just got a better head start. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
it's crazy.
But thanks for your question, Kathy.
Thank you for your video. And a reminder, anybody else that wants to do the same thing, send a video of yourself asking us a question. Send it to our email address at stonecoldandthejackal@gmail.com. and just do a podcast question in the subject line, and we will see it. And so that's super fun. Thank you so much, Kathy.
Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you to Sean. Thank you to everybody listening. I know some people have been having trouble finding our show on iTunes. I renumbered everything, so things should be
popping up correctly.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for sticking with us. And, we got a lot coming up. We got
new guests, lot on the road, got a lot of stuff happening, man. Can't
so
wait.
Make sure you're on our email list. Go to stonecoldandthejackal.com, say join our, click join our list. And get on our newsletter, because that is a way to make sure you're up to date with everything. So,
yeah.
Thank you guys as always, and we'll be talking we'll be talking to you next
week.
Have
a great day.
If you like our show, you're going to love Divorce Sucks with Laura Wasser on Podcast One.
And this week, Laura is in studio with the hilarious actress turned podcasting superstar, Anna Faris.
Download new episodes of Divorce Sucks with Laura Wasser every week on Podcast One.